Hello, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. Welcome to Lungcast. Human organ transplantation has come a long way over the last few decades. Lung transplants have certain challenges compared to other organs. For this reason, I felt it was important for this month's segment to feature a discussion among some key physicians involved with lung transplantation. However, before speaking to our experts, and in keeping with an historical component to our podcasts, I wanted to spend a few minutes on how the field of lung transplantation has evolved and point out some milestones. The number of lung transplants performed annually continues to increase, while at the same time the number of deaths occurring in patients on the waiting list for lung transplants decreases. Time to transplant after being listed, as of 2019, averaged about 3.5 months. The current survival rates for lung transplantation stand at about 90% at 1 year, 75% at 3 years, and 50% at 5 years, with an amazing 33% still alive at 10 years post-transplant. Interestingly, the imagination surrounding human organ transplantation can be traced back to Hindu mythology. Lord Ganesha, also known as Lord of the Peoples, is depicted as an elephant-headed Hindu god of beginnings, who is traditionally worshipped before any major enterprise. The myth goes that Lord Ganesha received an elephant's head after he was accidentally decapitated. An elephant was the first animal Lord Brahman came upon when trying to fix the problem. The myth began to turn into reality, at least for organ transplantation, when centuries later, in 1907, Dr. Alexis Carroll, working at the Rockefeller Institute, provided the technical basis of solid organ transplantation by being the first to describe various blood vessel connections and surgical techniques that would be needed. Later, Dr. Vladimir Demikhov refined the initial attempts at lung transplantation nearly 40 years later when he first transplanted heart and lungs in a dog in 1947. In the 1960s, after 7 years of experimental research on hundreds of animals, Dr. James Hardy at the University of Mississippi in Jackson obtained permission to perform lung transplantation in a human recipient with the following guidelines being set. The patient should have a potentially fatal disease. There should be a reasonable chance that he would benefit from the transplant. The removal of the patient's own lung should not result in significant loss of function of his or her remaining lung tissue, and the transplant would be performed on the left side since it was judged to be technically easier. As a result of his studies, and with those criteria in place, first human lung transplant was planned, and on June 11, 1963, Dr. James Hardy performed the first human lung transplant at the University of Mississippi. The patient undergoing the transplant had been diagnosed with advanced lung cancer and a lung abscess, and the odds of long-term success were not in Dr. Hardy's or, unfortunately, the patient's favor. Despite the deck being stacked against Hardy and his team, the surgery itself was successful, but the patient died 18 days later. However, this monumental day in the history of medicine was overshadowed by the shooting of a prominent civil rights activist named Medgar Evers. Evers was shot on the driveway of his home in Jackson, Mississippi, and was brought to the University of Mississippi Hospital Emergency Department. Dr. Hardy's chief resident, Dr. Martin Dalton, had to excuse himself from the transplant procedure to provide emergent care to Evers, but the attempts at resuscitating Evers were sadly unsuccessful, and he died. Dr. Hardy went on to complete the transplant, and after a successful surgery, he heard an uproar outside the operating room. Later, he learned that it was not in reaction to his landmark achievement, but rather in a pained response to Evers' tragic death. Between 1963 and 1980, only two lung transplant recipients had noteworthy post-transplant survival of 6 and 10 months, but no single patient survived long enough to be discharged from the hospital after the surgery. However, this trend was destined to change. Besides advancements and refinements in surgical techniques, the improvement in transplantation results was boosted by the advent of improved immunosuppressive therapy. Acute and chronic rejection of transplanted organs remains one of the main hurdles for long-term survival. The advent of cyclosporin, which was approved by the FDA in 1983, allowed for reduced steroid doses and for better anastomotic healing. Before the cyclosporine era, the world of lung transplantation relied on high-dose chronic steroids, immunosuppressive agents such as azathioprine, and even intense irradiation of the thymic region in the hopes of suppressing or delaying rejection. With the use of cyclosporine, however, Dr. Joel Cooper and his group reported the first long-term survivor in 1983, a 58-year-old man with end-stage fibrosis who received a right-sided single lung transplant. By 1987, Dr. Cooper had four long-term survivors. One of the limitations to the advancement of lung transplantation is the low number of available brain-dead donors and the low percentage of only 15 to 20% of lung procurement from those donors. Brain death and other complications associated with patients in an intensive care unit lead to the lungs being declined at the time of allocation. This continued donor shortage has made it necessary to expand the donor pool, with many centers using marginal donors who meet extended criteria for age, infiltrates, and smoking history, among others. For that reason, the most important step in expanding donor eligibility has been optimizing the donor management. So with this historical backdrop, let's see where the field of lung transplantation stands today. For that perspective, I had the opportunity to sit down with LungCast's first panel discussion interview with a trio of key members from the Cleveland Clinic Lung Transplant Program. Dr. Miriam Vallipor, pulmonologist and director of lung transplant outcomes at the clinic, as well as a senior investigator at the United States Scientific Registry of Transplant Recipients, is joined by Dr. Wayne Tuong, staff physician in pulmonary and critical care medicine at the Cleveland Clinic, and Dr. Carly Lair, a fellow in pulmonary and critical care medicine at the Cleveland Clinic. With Drs. Vallipor, Tuong, and Lair, we discussed lung transplant referral, research, and resourcing strategies, as well as the intricacies of transplant strategy inside and outside of dominating healthcare issues, including COVID-19 and gender outcome disparities. As the third program in the United States to ever complete 2,000 lung transplants, the Cleveland Clinic program serves as a rich resource to help us define the field of lung transplantation on this episode of LungCast. We hope you enjoy. Okay, well, I want to thank you all for joining us today. This is a very important discussion about lung transplantation. And what I thought we'd do is start out with just an overall question that I'll allow one or two of you to talk about, and that'll help us feed into some of the questions later on. But overall, as referring physicians and out the community for sure, what are some of the indications for lung transplantation, and how would a patient potentially access a transplant center to be evaluated? I know some of the common questions are, you know, what are the survival rates once I get transplanted, if I get transplanted? So that's really a wide open question. I'd like one or two of you to maybe address that as we start out.
Yeah, I can take this one. The most common indications for lung transplant are advanced lung diseases. So that's typically chronic obstructive pulmonary disease or COPD, interstitial lung disease like pulmonary fibrosis, cystic fibrosis, and pulmonary arterial hypertension. And transplant is typically considered when a patient's clinical status has worsened despite maximal medical or surgical therapy, when they have a limited life expectancy, and when they're starting to experience limitations in their activities of daily living. So the ideal person who's a candidate for transplant is someone who really has single organ failure, meaning just that their lungs have disease and it's not involving other organs. Because sometimes medical comorbidities can jeopardize their likelihood of a successful transplant. And I think to answer your last question, in terms of survival in the U.S., about 90% of people who get a lung transplant in the U.S. live to the one-year mark, and about 60% survive to 5 years.
Good numbers to know. And that, I'm sure we'll talk about the fact those numbers have been increasing over the years due to a lot of advances. Before referral to a transplant center, what are some of the advices you might give to a physician thinking about sending a patient, and what part of the evaluation should they do at the home site before necessarily sending them for transplant? And I guess the other thing you just touched on right now is what expectations should that referring physician give to the patient upon sending them to a referral center like yours?
Absolutely. I can take this one as well. I think it, you know, the caveat before I go into the details is that every transplant center is different. So developing a relationship with whichever transplant center you're referring your patients to is the most important thing. So, you know, their practices and their quirks. I think in terms of what can be done at a local center, it's different everywhere. Some, if they have a very good relationship with your center and know the quality of your, you know, your CAT scanner, your CATs, things like that, those can be done locally. But I always advise people to have their first visit with transplant before you start ordering tests so that we know exactly what the patient needs. I think when you're thinking about what to talk to your patient about, the kind of key points I think about are the early discussion of transplant is probably the most important thing. So it's not sprung on a patient when you're springing other things like their disease is so advanced that they need oxygen or talking about, you know, other end of life issues. It's a lot to take in at once. And I think really, you know, the thing that sets me up for success when I see a patient is when their referring pulmonologist has had kind of a realistic discussion about the risks and benefits of transplant. And that transplant isn't always an option for all patients. And going to the transplant center is part of deciding if that will be an option for the individual patient.
I know many times as a referring physician, I may not think the patient's necessarily the best candidate, but sometimes they do have to go to that center to hear it from the experts and to get the opinion of somebody who makes a decision about transplantation, to at least say they've tried every option they can at that point. Sometimes family members need that as well. So that's good to know. And I guess once they get to the transplant centers, there are specific studies that are best done at that transplant center. Is that correct?
Yeah, I can take that one. So you're right. There are many studies that are best done at the transplant center, but it's very individualized depending on the patient, how sick they are. You know, as noted earlier, that an evaluation is very multidisciplinary in nature, very holistic. We are really looking at the entire patient, not only from a psychosocial standpoint, but doing cardiac testing, doing testing on their GI tract to assess for acid reflux, to assess their bone health, to look for any history of osteoporosis. And so it involves multiple team members collaborating together to do a very holistic evaluation. So while a lot of tests are done at the main transplant center, there could be some that are done locally, and that's been best done in the conversation and the relationship between the referring pulmonologist and the transplant center. But the evaluations are very in-depth because we really are trying to look for that patient with single organ failure. But not every patient has that. There are lots of patients with many comorbidities. And when they have those comorbidities, we're trying to understand the extent of those comorbidities and do a proper risk-benefit evaluation of each individual patient based on all of our testing to make the best decision for a patient.
Great. Thank you, Wayne.
And, you know, I can add to that, Al, is that, sure. You know, different centers have different expertise. So it is really important to refer to a center and let them, in their evaluation, determine if they can address the comorbidities a patient has. You know, as our patient population is getting older and older, and with age comes comorbidities, right? So different centers have different levels of expertise and abilities to deal with comorbidities. So I think there is no blanket answer for this question. Right. It's best to refer to the center that you work with and have them determine if they can deal with the comorbidities the patient has. And if not, often they can refer to a center that potentially could. So that's actually something to consider.
And I guess the Cleveland Clinic is often known as a, you know, tertiary coronary referral center. You get people from all over the world for different types of procedures. From a transplant standpoint, do you get people outside of your area who are sent for evaluation? Is there any kind of geographic limitation for referring to the Cleveland Clinic?
I think I'm going to let Wayne answer this since this is his area of research.
It's a great question. Fantastic question. So, You know, for us here at Cleveland Clinic, I would say probably 50 to 60% of our patients are from within the state of Ohio. And then we take care of a lot of patients from outside the state of Ohio, as you mentioned, a major referral center. And so when the referral comes in, we invite patients to come in and meet with us and to go through an evaluation. And then we certainly want to partner with the referring physician, even if it's out of state, even if it's from a different region of the country, to care for the patient both in the pre and in the post-transplant setting. So while patients need to be close to Cleveland in the perioperative period, when they do go back home to their home communities, we definitely want to partner with the local pulmonologist to help with care over a large distance. And we've looked at our own data and we've shown that it's very doable, that in a collaborative partnership with the referring doctors, patients can have good outcomes regardless of the distance they have to travel to the transplant center.
Great. Oh, that's great. Great information. Great answer there. Mm-hmm. With a lot of transplantation, I think lung has one of the hardest ones, is getting the demand for the donors to not outstrip the supply. And I think the lung allocation scoring system that we have in place started around 2005. Can you discuss a little bit about the implementation of it and how it potentially changed the lung transplantation scene? And I think you're all working on some projects specifically around the lung allocation scoring system.
There's a short answer to this and a long answer. I'm going to do the long answer because it's more interesting. So prior to the implementation of the lung allocation score, lungs were basically allocated to candidates based on how much time they were had spent on the waiting list, their blood type, and then just the geographic proximity of the donor to the candidate. But we all know that risk of mortality is really different for different pulmonary diseases. And so what we were seeing at that time is really a different risk, different mortality rates for different patient populations. That would not come to any surprise to a pulmonologist on this call. So there were a lot of patchwork solutions to this. For example, the patients with pulmonary fibrosis had a disproportionately higher waitlist mortality. And so there was a solution that maybe we should add an extra 90 days on their, give them a credit of 90 days as they wait. They waited. The issue was that nothing really remedied the problem of this continuing increasing waitlist death on the mortality. And what basically resulted was we were transplanting really stable patients, right? They would have to be stable enough to survive a wait time of about 2 years on the waiting list. So as a clinician at the time, I didn't even think about listing someone, for example, who was on a ventilator, who had rapidly progressive pulmonary fibrosis, who was on a lot of oxygen, because I knew they wouldn't even survive the wait. So that really resulted in the 2005 changes to the organ allocation system to address one of the things that we hold most dear in the allocation in the organ transplant system, which is saving lives, right? So that's where the LAS went into effect, and it really addresses the need for medical urgency rather than how much time a candidate spends on the list. So the LAS is interesting as far as an allocation system is concerned because it not only considers waitlist mortality, but also likelihood of survival after transplant. So the way it's calculated, it models the risk of death on the waiting list over the next year and chances of survival over the next year if you were transplanted today. The weight of the waitlist mortality is two-thirds of the score, and the post-transplant survival is a third of the score. But in effect, because just about everybody lives the first year after transplant, it's really is the waitlist mortality that drives the access to lung transplant now. So the impact of that has really been that our waitlist has the characteristics of who is on the waiting list has changed completely. So from a cohort that was mostly COPD patients, right, in the past, because those are ones who could survive the wait, now we have, we're transplanting primarily pulmonary fibrosis patients who are actually quite ill, and patients with high lung with pulmonary fibrosis, and older patients that kind of go hand in hand, and both independently have high risks of mortality.
Good. And I'm assuming that when somebody gets listed, dependent on their clinical course, there's reassessment of that allocation score for physician notices, changes in condition, and how does that come about, notifying the center?
So the organization that kind of oversees all of the transplant system in the U.S. is called the Organ Procurement Transplantation Network. UNOS is a company that's administered that contract kind of since 1984. So, you know, the term is used interchangeably now. So UNOS or the OPTN requires that you update the score at least every 6 months. So when you have someone on the list, their score has to be updated at least every 6 months. There are caveats to that. But so that's a requirement, but also you can update the score as frequently as needed as a patient's status changes. So if your patient is getting sicker, you can change the score every day if you want. Now, if the score is very high, UNOS requires that you update the score more frequently just to make sure that if patients are improving, that they don't keep that high score. So others can access transplants appropriately.
In my readings, I think I saw the number of like a 3 to 4 month waiting list on average time. Is that an accurate number?
It is.
Just to add a clinical kind of snapshot to that. So if you look at patients who have an LES, you know, the number can start usually in the low 30s and go all the way up to potentially 100. So a patient who say has COPD and has some mild hypercarbia, maybe is wearing anywhere from 4 to 6 liters of oxygen, might have an average LES in the high 30s, just generally speaking. Whereas a patient who is acutely ill with high medical urgency and a high risk of death on the waiting list, let's say a patient with pulmonary fibrosis who is on a ventilator and has such severe disease, they have secondary pulmonary hypertension, their score may be potentially up in the 80s. And that would put that patient much higher on the waiting list for transplant. The score, as Miriam has indicated, uses over a dozen different clinical factors that our team will collect and then upload into the calculator to generate this score. But that kind of gives you an idea of the range of acuity and what the numbers capture for patients on the waiting list.
I'm going to add something else. You know, some may wonder how is it that suddenly the wait times are so much shorter. And it has two components to it. So one is we are better at obtaining organs now, and that we've done better. Our organ donor supply has gone up. We have new technologies for managing donors. That's one aspect of it. But in the past, the wait list was really falsely kind of inflated. Mostly because as pulmonologists, we knew our patients needed to wait at least 2 years, 3 years. So we would list patients for transplant way before they needed it. But now, because it's an urgency-based system, programs wait and list patients when they really think they need a transplant. They try to give themselves a little bit of a buffer. But this, you're not anticipating a 3-year wait, so the list is not falsely inflated.
You mentioned earlier some survival rates, and I, again, in my reading and preparing for this, I saw some maybe 10-year survival of 30% in some cases, which would have been unheard of 10, 20, 25 years ago. Can you talk a little bit about how things have changed with regard to the implementation of lung transplant, the selection of patients, and how we have changed the survival to such great degree over the years compared to before?
I'll start with that and then let Carly and Wayne kind of chime in. I would say short-term survival. So I define short-term survival less than a year and up to a year has improved significantly over the last few decades for lung transplant. I'll talk about it since the implementation of the lung allocation score. But I would you know, our long-term survival, you can look at it with a positive lens or a lens of frustration. And there are times I'm frustrated because, you know, we just haven't made the gains that I was hoping for. We've made great improvements, but our long-term survival gains have been somewhat modest compared to the short-term. So the short-term is reflecting how good we are, how much better we've gotten and medical management of patients. But our long-term survival, I think, has been a little bit more muted improvements, probably due to two factors. The LAS resulted in us transplanting much sicker and older patients. And with that goes limitations of survival, right? So that, you know, when someone arrives to transplant on ECMO, or they arrive to transplant at a much older age, that can potentially limit long-term survival. So we're talking 3, 5, 10 years. And the other is that we really have not made much gains in management of chronic rejection. We've gotten significantly better at acute rejection, but chronic rejection is an area of that is still to be conquered. And there's a lot of efforts in that in the scientific community. But I think once we manage to do that, our long-term survival gains will be much accelerated.
And do you think it's a combination of improved surgical techniques as well as improved medications that have helped as well?
I think management of patients prior to transplant, post-transplant, is certainly we are better at hospital care. Surgical techniques are better. We are better at infectious disease management. Kind of the protocols around critical care, right? All of those are major improvements. I don't know, Wayne and Carly have other ideas of why we have seen such improvement short term.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, a big part of what we do as transplant physicians is this patient selection. You know, you have a patient come to you and you have to kind of be able to make an educated decision about, do you think that they'll be fit enough to undergo the procedure? Do you think they'll tolerate a two-lung procedure or a one lung? Do you think that they would survive with a ventilator or ECMO? And I think, you know, one of the things that we've learned with the implementation of this LAS is how to better manage our critically ill patients and risk stratify appropriately. But I also think the other things you mentioned, you know, with anti-rejection protocols, improvement in medications, surgical techniques, all of those things have definitely played an important role.
And some of the you know, advancements or technologies in the perioperative period which have been very exciting include now using donors which are hepatitis C positive, whereas previously they were all excluded. So now we can transplant a patient from a donor that's Hep C positive into a recipient that's negative, and then use the new medications to treat hepatitis C. So it increases the donor pool, and it increases the number of patients that we can transplant. There's new technology now with ex vivo lung perfusion, which is the kind of lung in the box, which is allowing us allowing our surgical teams to recover lungs and improve them to a point where they can be used for transplant, which is also increasing the number of available donors and increasing the number of transplants that we can do. And then another technology component is ECMO as a way to stabilize patients with end-stage lung disease who can no longer ventilate on their own. This is a population now that can be sustained on these machines and then rehabbed and then evaluated. So these kind of advancements in the perioperative period are very exciting, and we're learning more and more about them and how best to implement them. But as noted with Mariam and Carly, that the Achilles heel for transplant remains chronic rejection, the long-term multi-year survival after the transplant. And we're still learning about the early diagnosis of chronic rejection, how best to subphenotype that diagnosis, and are there different kind of clinical trajectories with chronic rejection? So we're still learning quite a bit through multi-centered studies, and it is an Achilles heel, though, that we need to overcome.
I know some patients wonder about, they hear about single lung versus double lung transplantation. Can one of you just comment on what the thinking is and going into that decision process?
Yeah, absolutely. So each year in the US, about 75% of patients who get a lung transplant undergo a bilateral transplant. And factors such as what their disease process is, what their age is, comorbidities, and if they've had prior surgeries can determine our procedure type. And one of the things that I think as referring pulmonologists, look at, we see a lot of studies about is survival better with a bilateral or single transplant, because we all want what's best for our patient, right? And I think the tricky thing with these studies are that they've come to different conclusions. And that's because some of these studies are confounded by indications, right? So people who get a bilateral transplant are typically younger, more fit. They may be in better shape because the surgery to get a bilateral transplant is longer and has a tougher recovery. So we as pulmonologists already kind of self-select the population that gets a bilateral transplant. And those may be patients that are already going to live longer with the transplant, regardless of procedure type. And so single lung transplant can offer us a unique opportunity for patients who we think may have a higher risk of surgical mortality. So we would get them through a shorter operation and potentially a shorter post-operative stay. And so this may be a good option for people who are older, who don't have pulmonary hypertension, or who may need a concomitant procedure like a bypass graft. And then one of the other things that I think is a benefit of single lung transplant is that there's a societal benefit. So if we have a donor and we're able to use it for two single lung transplants, we've essentially helped two patients versus one patient with a bilateral.
Is that decision single versus double made ahead of time on the allocation scoring system, or is that made at the time of potential transplant?
That's a good question. For most patients, it's made ahead of time, but sometimes transplant centers can say single or bilateral, depending on if they feel equivocally about it. And then once a donor becomes available, that decision can be made. And you may wonder why we do that. And the reason we do that is to kind of open up the donor pool a little bit for some of those patients to give more options to get them a lung faster.
Just to add to that, so it's a center level decision, it's not a national decision. So that center chooses to do single or bilateral, and that's how it's listed nationally. The LAS or UNOS does not have a say in what procedure patients get.
So we can't get through an interview without talking about COVID these days. I had a chance to interview Dr. Ankit Bharat from Northwestern, who did one of the first, if not the first, double lung transplant for a COVID patient back in the summer of 2020. And wonder if you could just talk about some of the post or the transplant and post-transplant concerns when dealing with patients who have presented as a result of a significant infection that led to their advanced lung disease, and some of the caveats and some of the concerns that maybe at your center you've had to deal with since that COVID pandemic started about a year ago.
With the COVID pandemic, it has unfortunately led to a lot of patients with fibrotic lung disease as a sequela of the infection. So since the first transplant, as you mentioned, done by Northwestern, which was reported back in June of last year, there have been many more case reports about lung transplant for end-stage disease from COVID. So we are learning a lot more as time passes. I think one of the challenges that we are continuing to learn about is the timing for transplant for these patients. So a lot of times after a patient has reached the stage of fibrotic lung disease from COVID, the local teams and the ICU teams that have cared for these patients have really done heroic measures. That include from medications to measures like proning or the use of paralytics, or sometimes putting the patient on ECMO. But as a consequence of all these measures, patients are become very weak. They become very debilitated. So when patients come into a transplant center for evaluation, our first instinct is not to jump right in and do a transplant right away. What we're doing is doing a very thorough evaluation of each patient, looking at all the different organ systems, but also really focusing on rehabilitation and trying to improve on the patient's debility after being in the hospital or in an ICU for a significant period of time. So that's something that continues to be a focus on, which is getting patients stronger after they've been in the hospital for a very long time, because we know that the stronger they are going into a transplant, the better outcomes that they have afterwards. Now, for our patients who've had lung transplants, certainly it's been a very fearful time for them, as for everybody during the course of the pandemic. And we've continued to reinforce a lot of the measures that we've all learned to adapt, such as social distancing, frequent hand washing, wearing our face masks, and getting the vaccine when you are eligible in your local area to get it. So we've continued to reinforce those things with our patients. A lot of those things like hand washing and social distancing and face masking, we teach our patients anyways, and this even before the pandemic. And it's something we've continued to reinforce with all of them.
You touched on a subject that I wanted to not forget about. You said trying to make them stronger before they're transplanted. I think the role of pulmonary rehabilitation in these patients, even the stable COPD patients, is so important. But I'm assuming that plays a big role in maintaining your patients as functional as they can prior to coming to the transplant. So pulmonary rehab is certainly part of the prerequisite to for hopefully a good outcome. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely, 100%. I think even before a patient gets referred to a lung transplant center, if they participated in pulmonary rehab, that is wonderful. While they're on the wait list, we definitely encourage patients to keep up their physical activity and do pulmonary rehab if they can. And then after transplant, it's another big point of emphasis. In terms of data collection, pretty much every lung transplant center will do a 6-minute walk test as part of its evaluation, and is also as part of gathering data for the lung allocation score. And what we're really interested in on that 6-minute walk test is the distance that patients can walk. It gives us a very good idea of their overall fitness, their overall muscle strength, and it's a good indicator of how things will go in the peri-transplant time period. Now, the majority of patients are seen as outpatients, evaluated as outpatients, and when it's time for a transplant, they come from home to the transplant center. There's a smaller segment of patients who are in the hospital at the time of transplant, or even on ECMO, on that lung bypass machine. So even when they're in the hospital, a major focus is rehabilitation, doing exercises. And that's true for even patients on ECMO. We have our physical therapists come work with those patients on a regular basis in the ICU to try to maintain that muscle strength.
We may have touched on this a little bit earlier on, but besides the evaluation of the patient, the individual characteristics of that patient, are there any disease-specific numbers that show that maybe COPD does better than IPF compared to sarcoid or pulmonary hypertension when they're listed and then ultimately transplanted?
So the disease, the group that has the highest lung allocation score is also the group at the highest risk of mortality on the waiting list. And those two groups are your patients with pulmonary fibrosis and your patients with pulmonary hypertension. And they're also the ones with higher mortality post-transplant. So it's probably for different reasons, because you're really dealing with a different groups of people. So your pulmonary fibrosis patients are often much older and have many more comorbidities than your pulmonary hypertension patients. But pulmonary hypertension is actually a very significant disease and results in cardiovascular changes that impact the immediate perioperative period especially, and it is very hard to manage. So despite the fact that the lung allocation score actually has worked hard to catch these patients in time, increase their LAS to include more variables that reflect the risk of mortality for these population, they continue to have the highest mortality on the waiting list. And I think it's just the nature of the diseases.
There was an article, I think NIH put out in 2013, that discussed disparities occurring in lung transplantation before and after the LAS system that we discussed. Racial disparities in lung transplantation have decreased with the implementation of the LAS as a method of organ allocation. However, they talked about gender disparities may have actually increased in the LAS era. Can you comment on some of that data and how we're looking at it today?
You know, there's some papers that indicate that. I'm going to first address the racial disparity question. And that might be the hardest question you've asked me on this podcast. And mostly because I don't feel like I can answer the question because I don't know what the denominator is. So in other words, I could tell you about, we could tell you that, yes, once someone is on the list, there is no difference in access to transplant based on race, once on the list. But where the problem is, I don't know who should be on the list. And so this is why the disparities literature is hard to interpret, especially in lung, because we don't have a registry or a database that captures patients throughout the progression of their pulmonary diseases. And so I only know about individuals who after they're listed. So if someone is referred and not listed, I don't know about that. And if it's appropriate or inappropriate, I still have no way of evaluating it. And I certainly have no idea about who should have been referred that hasn't been referred. So I think this is actually a major black box in our databases in the US, and something we need to kind of work on. We've made some efforts in merging the US transplant registry with other databases, trying to identify who should be really referred to us and who has and who hasn't. The issue is that most diseases don't have great chronic disease registries, kind of the big ones that we need to follow patients. We have done this with the CF population. The CF patient registry captures their patients from birth on. So we've been able to manage to merge the databases and identify who should be referred and when they are. But again, I really couldn't tell you about racial disparities until you can tell me what the denominator is. They've done a better job in that in other organ transplants.
Yeah, I mean, as the Lung Association, health equity is a big issue around a lot of diseases that we deal with. And I think that's a great answer that you gave. We need to know better the baseline data out there.
We do.
And it also speaks to the need for awareness as well. So, you know, major societies like the American Lung Associations are great platforms to raise awareness about lung disease, that it is a major cause of mortality in the United States, having end-stage lung disease even before the pandemic. And so with increased awareness about lung disease, the burden that it places on society, through platforms like the American Lung Association, people will recognize it more. And then hopefully that can prompt, you know, the community providers, pulmonologists, to make referrals to the lung transplant centers so that we can evaluate these patients and educate patients about transplant.
The other question I had is, you know, we learn a lot about patient journeys, patient stories. It really has impact for physicians as well as patients. Can you give me a typical example, maybe a patient's journey through the process when they're referred to you until they ultimately get listed with their allocation score?
So, you know, patients, you know, come from varied backgrounds. They may have different, or they often do have, you know, they have different diseases that lead to end-stage lung disease. So a lot of times it starts with the referral from a primary care doctor to a pulmonologist that they know. And they establish a relationship with the pulmonologist. The pulmonologist certainly is going to try everything they can to, you know, stabilize the chronic lung disease, to improve a patient's quality of life. But when they feel that they've exhausted the medical options, or they feel like the patient is worsening despite medical options, they'll make the referral to a lung transplant center. And so each lung transplant center will do their evaluation a little bit differently. But the general themes are going to be you know, meeting the patient, doing a very thorough evaluation, which involves a psychosocial component, doing a very thorough medical workup. It involves not only looking at the lungs with CAT scans and breathing tests, but also the possibility of heart CATs to understand if there's any coronary disease, to do a lot of esophageal testing. Because I think a lot of pulmonologists recognize that acid reflux is a big part of having a chronic lung disease. It can also affect patients after transplant. So we want to be able to quantify and measure the degree of acid reflux if it's in a patient. Also looking at bone health and looking for any evidence of either osteopenia or osteoporosis, because our patients take steroids usually for life after the transplant. So it's a very thorough evaluation, very holistic. And then, as you noted, that rehab is a very big component of that. So as the patient goes through the evaluation, they'll meet different members of the team. And then every transplant center has a group or a committee that will convene regularly and then look at all the data that's been collected as part of the evaluation. And then they'll make a recommendation as to whether the benefits of going through a transplant outweigh the risks. It's also at that time they'll make decisions about whether a single or double lung transplant should be offered and put that on the listing sheet. So once a patient is officially listed, they'll know what that lung allocation score number is, that LAS. That gives them an idea of kind of how sick they are and kind of where they are on a waiting list. There'll be regular appointments with the transplant center to update clinical data, which will be used to update the LAS. The frequency of those appointments, it depends on the acuity of a patient, but it also depends on the practices of the transplant center. If the patient is living a far distance from a transplant center, they may have to move temporarily to be closer to the transplant center, just depending on the practices of that particular center. But I think the main thing, you know, with the being on the waiting list is, one, we want patients, if they can, to stay active and exercise and rehab. And then the second is keep your telephone always on. Always have it on and have it close by. Just be ready for that call.
Right. We've covered a lot of ground here. And I certainly have learned a lot. I'd like these podcasts to get to learn from experts like yourself. Just to round out today's discussion, are there views you have about where the future of lung transplantation is going? And are you doing certain research that you'd like to tell us about in the area?
No, I was just going to talk a little bit about some of our joint work and talk a lot about how lung transplant is really an opportunity for where you can bring work with big databases back to the bedside. So a lot of the work that Dr. Vallipore and I do together is about organ allocation, which I'll let her talk more about that. But one of the populations that we've really been able to help with some of our research is the cystic fibrosis population. And we've been able to kind of extrapolate back from using our joint database with the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation database and the SRTR, which I don't think we've talked about yet, but that's the Scientific Registry of Transplant Recipients. That's all the US transplant database. And what we've done is we've been able to look back at risk factors that aren't in the current allocation score and which of those may be specific for subpopulations. So for cystic fibrosis, we found that there are certain risk factors that we don't account for. So Dr. Vallipore and I have been able to bring that back to the clinic to kind of identify this special population and kind of see what are red or yellow flags that develop while they're waiting to help them survive to the point of getting a transplant.
So one other thing that I think I'm going to add to Dr. Lehr's work, and then so what she is recently not only is doing this data work, but is piloting an effort where she can monitor patients with cystic fibrosis who are on the waiting list on a weekly basis, or if they're feeling sicker on a, you know, more frequently, by they fill out a health assessment that's online and they do home spirometry. And so we monitor these numbers in real time. And if there's a certain decline based on our protocol, we call them back in, evaluate them, update their LAS accordingly, and hopefully improve their access to transplant in a timely way. Because the key is to transplant people when they're sick enough to have a transplant benefit, but not so sick that return will diminish. So this is kind of another effort that Dr. Lehr is involved in. I would say there's, to answer your question about where we're going, I'm impatient and excited about all the places we're going. I've been involved with the LAS work since 2010. And we've really made a lot of effort on several fronts to do the work to make sure the system serves the patient population appropriately. And how does it do that is by capturing real indicators of worsening status. So we are always trying to improve the accuracy of the LAS, but including variables that were not available in the past. We update the patient population regularly because they're changing. Their risk of mortality is changing and who we transplant changes. And so the baseline risk assessment of the models needs to change. And we've been very active in doing that. Recently, we have some funding from the National Institute of Health in looking at how patients progress over time on the waiting list. So that, you know, if you have a low FVC and a high creatinine at the beginning of listing, the implication of that and how those factors interact may be very different at the beginning than if you're still waiting 3 months in. And so we're working hard to simulate, to build these models basically, so that we can simulate who is more likely to progress more quickly. So we provide them better access to a transplant. And then also knowing who can wait. I think that's actually important because there are times that you can, there's benefit to the individual if they can wait longer, right? Because just based on survival after transplant, you want to delay transplant to the point that it's absolutely necessary. But also there's a societal benefit so that if you can delay transplant here, you can transplant someone else who's more urgent and then transplant the person in need next. So finding that balance is actually key. So that's the empiric kind of big data work that we're doing. We're also a coordinating center for a big effort for 15 lung transplant programs that have gotten together to develop a biorepository and a database to study chronic rejection, what we talked about, which is the Achilles heel of transplant, to understand kind of the molecular pathology, observational data about this disease, where we have a very granular database and specimen biorepository to conduct studies.
I think it's a very, very exciting time to be in, not only in pulmonary medicine, but in lung transplant. Just to echo some of the other comments, you know, looking at the major diseases for which we do transplants, there have been major developments in new medications, whether it be, you know, cystic fibrosis to pulmonary hypertension and pulmonary fibrosis, including and as well as COPD. So with all the new medications, there's the potential to delay the need for transplant. And so that's a very exciting area of the last several years. And then transplant itself is an extremely exciting field because there are so many rapid changes. And I think we still have a lot of ways to go, a lot of progress to be made. You know, the average survival of a lung transplant overall remains about 5 to 6 years. That is well below the other solid organ transplants. Whether you look at heart transplant, liver transplant, or kidney transplant, our overall survival numbers remain very low in comparison. So there's a big gap, which means we have a lot of work to do, but it makes the field very, very exciting in terms of what we have coming up ahead to try and help our patients.
Well, this has been certainly informative and very optimistic as well, based on the research that you're doing. And I want to thank you for that. I want to thank you for taking the time today and look forward to seeing some of your research bear the fruits of all your hard work. So thank you again.
Thank you for your time.
you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you again to Drs. Valipour, Tuan, and Lair for their exceptional perspective in lung transplant trends and practices in this, our first panel interview on Lungcast. Their work, as part of a nationally leading transplant team, shines through the conversations alone. And thanks to all of you for joining our conversation this month. As daunting as the subject of lung transplant can be for respiratory caregivers and patients alike, understanding the field is a vital factor in our continued advancement toward optimal care. We hope you learned a thing or two, as we certainly did. So be sure to subscribe to Lungcast on your favorite podcast platform and register on both lung.org and hcplive.com for more respiratory health news and insights. For now, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters, so just take it one breath at a time.